two of the major themes in what I work on is how does L&D start looking beyond the course to supporting performance? And when it does courses, do courses right. Stop doing them for everything. Reserve those resources for when it really has to be in the head, and then do it right.
This is the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast, brought to you by Nessel and Associates, a Newport Beach, California-based ERP organizational change management firm serving the private equity industry. The ERP OCJ seeks to share expertise, insight, experience, and research, and to create effective conversation to help guide ERP organizational change to real, measurable, and verified success. And now, here's your ERP expert and host, the founder of Nessel & Associates, Dr. Jack Nessel.
Hey, Jack here. Thanks for joining us for another great conversation. On today's episode, we discuss an ERP critical success factor, organizational learning, with Dr. Clark Quinn. Dr. Quinn is an executive director at Quinnovation and has been involved in the design, development, and or evaluation of a wide variety of educational technology for over 30 years. He keynotes both nationally and internationally and is the author of numerous articles, chapters, and books. Dr. Quinn has to date written 6 books at the intersection of learning and technology, including his most recent, which are Learning Science for Instructional Designers, Millennials, Goldfish, and Other Training Misconceptions, and Revolutionize Learning and Development. Dr. Quinn serves as a director and treasurer for the International Board for Standards in Training, Performance, and Instruction, and is on the advisory board for the Learning Development Accelerator in Boise State's program in Organizational Performance and Workplace Learning. So Hieroff and colleagues published an article in 2011 that provided insight and awareness of the value of an educational training process required for implementation and how in an ERP deployment, there are some issues related to the training and learning process. Moreover, a clear understanding of the role and responsibilities in this learning process is crucial to ensure the success of ERP implementation. Stakeholders need to practice, understand, and implement the practice of thinking about thinking in order to provide clear roles and responsibilities and a methodical model with a loopback mechanism for effective learning. So during an ERP organizational change effort, the organization needs a general culture of learning. And the literature demonstrates clearly that there's a unanimous acceptance, understanding, and mindset among stakeholders regarding the value of organizational learning during a large-scale ERP implementation, and it's a critical success factor. Scott also published a paper in 2018, and we'll share these references in our show notes as well. But Scott stated that learning and adapting are critical if organizations want to prosper and endure in a continuously changing global environment. Furthermore, Scott examined the role of organizational learning in the context of information technology implementations and determined that learning is an important component of organizational survival. It is important that organizations value learning via two approaches, from their own experience and from the experience of others. Organizations that can recognize, advocate for, and adequately execute organizational learning tactics increase the likelihood of ERP success. So let's examine with our next guest the influences that could enhance learning and performance in an organization through research-based principles. This episode will further examine organizational learning and how, as Clark describes, learning science allows L&D to design and make decisions on a sound understanding of how we think, work, and learn, a quote by Clark, our next guest. We will explore several topics with Clark, including learning principles founded in sound research, learning myths and why they are appealing, why L&D should be a strategic influence during ERP organizational change, learning and development and organizational performance, challenges of effective learning and development, measurement and evaluation, and more. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area, welcome to the show, Clark.
Thank you, Jack. A pleasure to be here with you.
Absolutely. We're really looking forward to this conversation and having you share some of your insight with our listeners. So thank you very much for joining us today. Clark, please tell us more. Please further introduce yourself to our listeners.
Sure. And that was a very gracious introduction. Thank you so much. Really, the critical thing is you were mentioning that I've created my own degree in computers and learning, and I'd been doing some computer science classes, and I've been tutoring on campus for some money. And I got a job doing the computer support for the office that organized the tutoring. And a light sort of went on. I said, computer supporting learning, is this a real thing? And I looked around and it was. And that's how I ended up being able to design my own major in it. But the interesting thing is that's become my passion, recognizing that taking what we know about how our brains work and applying that to the use of technology in organizations, because the sad fact of the matter is there isn't very good alignment between how our brains work and what we do in organizational efforts. Thus, it's not only been a passion to continue to do this, but there's a clear continuing need to do it even after these decades. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I want to remind our listeners that that passion was inspired back in 1979, right?
Yeah, so exactly.
Clark, how would you define L&D for our listeners?
Sure. Individuals come in with certain level of skills and they're asked to perform. And the question is, do they have the skills? And as things are increasingly changing, those skills need to be updated. Plus, they need resources to succeed as well. The full ability for people to perform is more complex than just what's in their head. It's what's in their environment, in the culture of the organization. So to me, learning and development is the unit in the organization that's charged with ensuring that people have the skills and resources to succeed in the roles that they are occupying.
So to follow up on that, Clark, why does L&D matter in the context of organizational or in the context of organizations or educational in the classroom learning? I mean, there's a correlation between effective L&D and improvements in organizational and or individual performance, correct?
Yes, indeed. When we do learning right, we can substantially improve the ability of people to perform. We need to be careful to focus, realizing that changing the knowledge in the head doesn't clearly change what people can do in the workplace. And the notion of, you know, dumping a bunch of information, actually I've been looking at this recently, and it has to do with, you know, it's still the industrial age model of we get turned people into cogs in the machine. But we also have this model that says we're these formal logical reasoning beings. And if we put information in the head, then they will change their behavior to adapt and do differently. And it turns out that's not very good. But so it's interesting, you were citing some studies. Well, Beer et al. Wrote a paper for Harvard Business Review called The Great Training Robbery. And you were talking about how when L&D does stuff successfully, it leads to ERP success. But their study pointed to a meta-analysis that suggests that only 10% of training investments actually lead to any meaningful improvement in the organization. So that critical word of effective L&D improvements is crucial.
That's a great point, Clark. I really like that. And I like that article too. And I'm going to share that in our show notes with our listeners. You know, I think you're right. That is a very key word, and that's effective L&D, because isn't it true? There's a lot of L&D practice out there, but that practice, which is most founded in, I would say, principle and science for a variety of reasons, tends to be the most effective and efficient learning and development practice. I mean, is that a fair statement?
Well, if I heard you correctly, you're saying that, you know, what we're practicing is the most efficient thing. And by and large, that's not the case. Yeah. So too often we see corporate learning look like bullet points. And if we're lucky, there's a quiz at the end to see if people have been able to change what they know. And that's just contrary to what we know about how humans actually learn. A bunch of knowledge dump and knowledge test. In cognitive science, we call this inert knowledge. You'll go out in the real world, you'll have studied it, you'll have passed a test on it. And when you go out there and need to apply it, it won't even get activated because you've never used it in the way that it needs to be used in the actual workplace. And so that's a big distinction between large amount of current practices and what we know really works.
Yeah, that's well said, Clark. I think that was the point I was attempting to make. So in other words, effective L&D, again, is different from L&D. I think in the general, in L&D practice in general, and in ERP organizational change for sure, there's a significant room for improvement in terms of organizational learning. And I think that that applies certainly in terms of in organizations, but I think obviously in the classroom as well, that these principles that you talk about in your books and in your work do matter. And there is a big difference between effective L&D and L&D.
Well, absolutely. And it goes beyond the courses. if you recognize your own development and some of what gave you the capability to do what you do today came from classes, but then it was refined through performance, feedback from colleagues, feedback from mentors and coaches, your own experimentation and reflection. And one of the things that leads to successful performance is not trying to put it all in the head, but what can we put in the world? When you start adding job aids and checklists and context-sensitive help, you increase the ability for people to perform without having to run a training course.
Yeah.
So you want to look at that full spectrum of performance to truly find ways to enable. And in some orgs, they shift that off away from L&D and other people create the job aids, but you really want somebody who understands how our brains process information and actually operate to be the ones guiding this sort of solution design that goes beyond the training. Many years ago, Don Norman wrote a book, The Invisible Computer, and he talked about how they didn't bring usability up front soon enough. And so they'd make a system and then engineer it and then ask the people to design an interface. And the people who design the interface would go, look, if we design an interface to do the way you've designed it, we know they're going to have trouble because it's ugly. And the same thing with the trainers. If you bring them up front, if you go, oh, we're going to do this, they can tell you, wait a minute, that's going to be really hard to train people to do. And if you just switch this, you would find everything else work much easier. There's a whole bunch of types of knowledge that come into play in performance that you really want to bring in up front before you design this whole ARP and then just ask them to train it.
Yeah, great insight. Clark, you mentioned on your website that, quote, L&D isn't doing near what it could and should, and what it is doing badly. Other than that, it is fine, end quote. How so? What do you mean by this? Can you tell our listeners more?
That was a deliberately provocative statement. And yet, as many provocative statements, there's some element of truth. So that's just reflecting what I just said. You know, when it isn't doing near what it could and should, it should be going beyond the course. It should be looking at performance support. It should be looking at facilitating informal learning and innovation, because in theory, learning and development should be the people that understand most about this. And informal learning is still learning. Then the second part, what it is doing, it's doing badly. That's the whole point about throwing up bullet points and thinking that's the equivalent to effectively changing people's ability to do. So it's just a concise way of stating two of the major themes in what I work on is how does L&D start looking beyond the course to supporting performance? And when it does courses, do courses right. Stop doing them for everything. Reserve those resources when it really has to be in the head and then do it right. There's an approach called performance consulting that's really interesting. One of the premises that underlies this is that when people aren't capable of performing, there may be multiple potential causes. It could be that they don't have the right resources. It could be that they believe they're supposed to do something else. It could be that they're not the right people, or it could be that there aren't the right things in their head. Training only solves that last one. So first you want to do an upfront analysis and say, what are the barriers? Now for a new ERP system, you sort of have to anticipate how are people going to perform. I talk about a backwards design where you look at the final performance and say, what's in the world and what's in the head? Then you go back and you build the tool, you know, the information that can be in the world. And then finally you build training to put the what needs to be in the head into the resources. So the issue is that when you need a course, answering that question says when your performance analysis says we do need significant new skills. They don't have it. It's not a fine tuning. It's not changing their incentives to get them to do the right thing. They actually don't have the skills. That's when you use a course. But you really have to do that upfront work to ensure that you validated that a course is what's going to solve the problem. When you got somebody saying, oh, I need a course on this, they may not actually know what works. And one other side note about not doing, you know, what they are doing, they're not doing well. Everybody knows what school looks like. So if the training looks like a classroom, they think that it's got to be effective and they sort of forget that their own schooling wasn't that effective, right? So I can be a bit contrary, you know. So that's the point is stop using courses as the only tool in your quiver. Find the right match of problem to tool and use the right tool. And when you use that tool, do it right.
Just very interesting. Clark, you recently wrote a blog titled Reading Research, and I believe that was in September. And I appreciated it. And I found that to be interesting. So I want to share some of that with our listeners. And I think it's really a follow-up to your myths book, actually, in which you discuss how we properly develop learning science that informs us in reading research. And you also share that you, I think like myself, you see yourself as an advocate and a promoter for sharing research. And I think this article, in a way, gets to the heart of what this podcast is all about, frankly. And so I don't want to paraphrase just because I want to drive home your thought. So allow me to share a couple of excerpts, and then I have a question for you. You first say in this blog, quote, "Generally, theory drives research. You've created an explanation that accounts for observed phenomena better than previous approaches. What you do then is extend it to other predictions and test them. Occasionally, we do purely exploratory studies just to see what emerges, but mostly we generate hypotheses and test them. We do this with some rigor. We try to ensure that the method we devise removes confounding variables, and then we use statistical analysis to remove the effects of other factors," end quote. And then the second quote here, Clark, is then you go on to say, quote, "Moreover, we then need to share this with our colleagues so that they can review what we've done. We need to do it in an unambiguous language using the specific vocabulary of our field, and we need to make it scrutable. Thus, we publish in peer-reviewed journals, which means others have looked at our work and deemed it acceptable. However, the language is deliberately passive, unemotional, and precise, as well as focused on very narrow topic. Thus, it's not a lot of fun to read unless you really care about the topic," end quote. And then you state there are problems with this. Can you explain to our listeners why you say that and why this is important to effective L&D?
Sure. Really, L&D should be grounded on foundational principles, just like medicine and legal issues and everything else should be, you know, professionally grounded. So we need to understand the science. The problem is, first of all, it can be hard to read. And second of all, not all research is the same. So it's wonderful if you have been trained to reach it. And there are a number of my colleagues who have been trained as academics and yet are now out in the real world, and they serve as very effective translators. There are a lot of other people who claim they're citing research and really aren't, and they're not as trustworthy. So you want to find these people who've built up the reputation. The problems with the science, so when I say there are problems with this, one of the problems is that a lot of the studies were done because of convenience with undergraduate US college students, which is great if they are representative of your audience. And some of the research is going into fundamental cognitive principles, and it's not influenced by contextual factors or cultural factors. And you can trust that research, but other stuff that they've done turns out doesn't replicate when you try it with other cultures. There was research done on if you were given $100 and you could get somebody else to agree to accept as much as you will give them, you get to keep the rest. And then it was a matter of based upon how could you provide sufficient stuff to person for the US, you know, when they did this with US students, about $50 you'd have to give to the other person. In other words, an equal split or close to it to get it. Then they went and did it in Peru and they found out that people were happy with just $5 out of the 100. And then they said, I'll accept that because their culture was sort of like, wow, you know, here's a gift you weren't going to have otherwise. Why would you fight with it? In other cultures, they totally resist. I don't want any of this. This has entailments. I don't want it. You just take it. You can have it all. I want zero. And so these research results were not replicable when you took them broader. We're also finding some replicability problems in some other experiments that thought were to be rigorous. So part of the problem is that things are more complex. You know, where I was just saying in that quote that we carefully control the confounding variables and use statistical analysis. Well, sometimes we remove some of the things that actually interact with and affect the outcome, which isn't to say that we don't have really good, robust prescriptions for science. But as you look at it in a more holistic manner to actually achieve organizational impact, you can't just design it and launch it and think it's good. You're going to have to trial it and test it and refine it before it's actually going to work, because we're just complex beings. Yeah. Arguably, our brains are the most complex thing in the known universe, right?
Absolutely. So, Clark, would you say that for sound research, would you say that the lack of effective research translators is one reason why L&D is not necessarily effective L&D? That is, research isn't transferred to effective practice?
I wouldn't blame it on the translators. They're trying as hard as they are, but they're speaking into a environment that has a multitude of factors conspiring against their effectiveness.
Yeah.
So that includes vendors with barrows to push, bandwagon, not enough people having the background. A famous book that came out from a colleague, The Accidental Instructional Designer, really necessary book, really good book. But the fact that it's necessary says a lot about our field. You know, you don't have accidental project managers. Typically, you may get some, but you tend to ground them. And so there's multiple factors that makes it difficult. The translators are, you know, sending good messages. And I have evidence that there's growing awareness. You know, if you look at the rate of which books about learning science have come out, that has accelerated, which is a very positive sign. But there's still a long way to go. We have good prescriptions and we have good gaze. One of the reasons you understand learning sciences theory is so you can fill in the gaps between what instructional design prescriptions say, because they can't cover every situation. So you make your best guess, but then you need to test it and refine it. And one of my first tests for if somebody's trying to sell you something new is coming by and going, oh, here's the latest and greatest is, well, let's cut it down and say, is that really relevant to me? What would it mean I would do differently? And what would be the different results I would get? And are those results I care about? Because yeah, you should be able to push away a number of things that have been pushed because when you really cut down to it, they aren't relevant. And you have to be careful because people will tell you it's grounded in their research, but the research is proprietary because it's their competitive advantage. That should be a huge warning sign. There's a bunch of things people are using like MBTI and some other personality assessments that have no real independent scientific basis. And in fact, they've been demonstrated to be problematic. You can't just look at statistical significance. You've got to look at it in context and expect that it's going to vary for you. And in fact, I argue against the phrase best practices, because that's where you go in and you take what somebody else did and try and do it in your firm instead of abstracting the best principles, moving them over and recontextualizing you.
That's a great one, Clark. Can you elaborate a little more on the idea of best practices versus best principles?
Well, what happens is it worked in that company because they'd instantiate it for their way of working, their culture. If it is working there, there's a number of contextual factors that when you try and move it into your company, you probably don't have the exact same context. And therefore, there's a lot of failure of trying to import best practices and replicate the same thing. And it doesn't work for you in the same way because you're in a different company. But if you understand the principles behind those practices, what they say about how to work, and then you re-engineer them for your context, not taking them just straight over, but understanding them and redesigning them for the way things work in your organization, you're going to have a much higher likelihood of success. It's abstracting the underlying mental models instead of just taking the rote practices.
Clark, clearly, or maybe not so clearly, effective and efficient L&D requires effective and efficient measurement and evaluation. And you have an article titled Iterating and Evaluating, in which you state that, quote, I've argued before about the need for evaluation in our work. This occurs summatively, where we're looking beyond smile sheets to actually determine the impact of our efforts. However, it also should work formatively, where we're seeing if we're getting closer. Yet there are some ways in which to get off track, end quote. Can you speak more to measurement and evaluation in the L&D process?
Yes and yes. So I think the barriers to it are understanding that need for the abstraction and the difference between practices and principles. People look for easy solutions and aren't brains, contrary to that belief that we're formal logical reasoning beings. We're increasingly getting a lot of evidence we're not, and we will go for shortcuts if we can, because doing cognitive work is exhausting. So there are a lot of things we should be doing that we're not, and that includes measurement. And in L&D, it's a sad state of affairs that a lot of people do not evaluate the impact of what they do. And even if you look in one of the major societies publishes a report on metrics in the organization, everything is about how efficient they are. How many people do we serve for each of our L&D employees, you know, and how many hours does it take us to develop an hour of content, and a bunch of measurements like that, which are all about efficiency. And they're not saying if we develop that hour of content, we actually get this measurable improvement in sales or operations or marketing or whatever it is. So it's critical. We need to be evaluating impact. And that gets back to that performance consulting I mentioned up front beforehand. When somebody says, please develop a course for me, your response should be, yes, okay, how will we know it's successful? What measure will have changed so that we know we've done it? And if we only achieve part of that, we know we'll have to go back and tune it some more because we have to get to this level. That sort of absolute measurement of impact is just almost unknown in L&D, and that creates a big barrier for us being successful.
Clark, in your blog, Making It Meaningful, we'll have a link to your blog site as well. I think you have a lot of great and meaningful blogs. But you state that, quote, to get people willing to invest in learning, you have to help people see that they need to do it. Also, they don't need to know it now and that this experience will change that. You need to be engaged in making it meaningful, end quote. So in general, Clark, can you share with our listeners the framework in which to do that? I know that's a loaded question, but just kind of in general.
Sure. There's a lot of work on engagement learning. To me, learning experience design, which is a new buzz phrase, but I like it because it adds something. The traditional instructional design framework is focused on instruction. And to me, learning experience design, the elegant integration of learning science and engagement. We know that when people are emotionally engaged, they learn more effectively. We want to focus it, and there hasn't been good guidance. Recently, it was introduced to DC and Ryan's self-determination theory, which provides a framework for thinking about it. And ideally, you get this true intrinsic motivation, which says, oh, I'm curious about this. But you can't guarantee that. And it's really individual. And so many people do just things like tart it up, put up a bunch of knowledge dump in a quiz show context, you know, so you are getting points and leaderboards. And that's not good enough. And intrinsic motivation is too hard. So is there something in between? And I say we can get them to the stage where, you know, I don't know it and I do need to know it. And you also have to convince them that this experience will change that. But to do that, I think you have to help them see the consequences of this learning, that if I don't learn it, these bad things happen. And you can do that humorously or dramatically. And the same thing, if I do this, I will be able to achieve these goals. And again, those can be made dramatic or meaningful. But I think you have to viscerally hook people. And I think there are systematic ways to do it. That's stuff I've been working on for the past year plus, developing workshops in my next book. And at core, it's really about first you have to hook them emotionally, then you need to maintain that engagement throughout the experience. But what I'm talking about specifically there is just that initial hook. And I think we should be focusing on that. We don't do a good enough job on it. There's a big opportunity to make our learning much more, at least to get our learners to engage with it initially.
Clark, in another article that you wrote titled Misaligned Expectations, you were writing about a learning development conference in which you attended. And I felt that it had some interesting ideas on the expectations of L&D. And in this article, you stated that, quote, given that the focus is on evidence-based approaches, a group set up a separate discussion room for learning science. Interestingly, though perhaps not surprisingly, our discussion ended up including barriers. One of the barriers, as has appeared in several guises across recent conversations, are the expectations on L&D. Some of them are our own, some of them are others, but they all hamper our ability to do our best. So I thought I'd discuss some of these misaligned expectations, end quote. Please share more with our listeners.
I referred to one already, that people who've been to school expect L&D training to look like schools. And that's, for instance, an expectation that others will have upon L&D. You know, just make it look like a classroom and you're done. Don't bother me with all this experiential learning garbage. But other expectations come in as well. After 2001, when nobody wanted to travel, they took all the trainers and they gave them authoring tools and said, you're now an instructional designer. And they took their training and they put it online. And if you took those tools were, you know, specifically designed so that you could dump a PowerPoint or a PDF into it, add a quiz, and you get online learning. And people could do this quickly. So there became an unreasonable expectation that, oh, well, it only takes a couple weeks to develop a course. Yes, if you want to develop a bad course, but throwing a bunch of content, as I've already mentioned, at people and adding a knowledge quiz doesn't equate to actual change in behavior. that's another expectation that people have. And then we have our own expectations. As long as we make people happy, it is good. In my next to most recent book on learning myths, I talk about some misconception or actually superstitions that people have. They don't really claim they believe this, but it shows up in their work. And one of them is, if I make it flashy and dump a bunch of content and add a quiz, I've made a good learning experience. And that's our own misaligned expectation, because it's just not true. But again, when we have accidental instructional designers and you hear what the vendors push and you go to the conferences and the exposition halls and see what they're telling you, and even some award-winning stuff actually shouldn't have gotten awards for anything to do with learning, because they're just not aligned with how things should work.
So Clark, quick question. How does that relate to the efficiency metrics that we discussed or the targets that L&D actually sets for itself?
Well, one of the metrics they use is how many courses we crank out per year. And if you're looking at sort of 2 weeks vision of courses, you can crank out a lot. But if you're not evaluating whether the courses you're producing are actually leading to any meaningful change, it's a mug's game, right? You wouldn't stand up to scrutiny about your expenditures. But CFOs aren't asking that of the L&D department. The L&D department isn't asking that of themselves. They're measuring, did people like it? Well, people loved our courses and they thought it would really help them work. It turns out people's assessment of the quality of the impact of a course and its actual impact, the correlation is 0.09. That's zero with a rounding error. There's no correlation between how people evaluate. And yet 96% of organizations will actually ask smile sheets. You know, did you like the course? When you go down to, did they actually pass a test at the end of it? It drops to a third. If you ask, you know, did it lead to any change in the workplace? Only an eighth of the orgs are doing that. When you actually ask, did it lead to any meaningful change in the organization itself? It gets down to about 3%, which is back to zero with a rounding error. I mean, we're not evaluating impact. And that's a fundamental problem. In fact, I'll argue that the most important change L&D could do is start measuring their impact. Actually measure their impact. If they did that, they would find out that they're not having one, and that might drive them to begin to look to improve. But if you don't,
interesting.
It's the old, what you measure matters.
Yeah, right. What do you think they're afraid of finding? Maybe that their work is not effective, that it's not effective L&D, or at least not as effective as it could be.
I think that's exactly right. First of all, it's too hard because they can't do that on their own. They have to now partner with the business unit asking for the course and work with them to get the numbers, because L&D doesn't have access to the numbers. Whatever business unit they're working with, whether it's sales or operations, has the numbers. So they have to work with them to get the numbers, which is out of their comfort zone. Yeah. Then the second thing, I think you're absolutely right, is that they're also scared to actually look at the answer. They have certain operational measures they're caring about, which includes how efficient they are, and they're deluding themselves because it's convenient that that's all they have to do.
Clark, I think that many L&D professionals recognize that there are many learning myths that are perhaps not really founded in principle. And you had another article, and it was titled "The Message to CXOs 2 about Organizational Learning Myths." But in that article, you share that there can, quote, be misconceptions about learning with L&D, but it can also be outside perspectives that are flawed. So hopefully I've now addressed both. I don't claim that this is necessary and complete, just certain things that are worth noting. These are organizational learning myths that are worth trying to overcome, or so I think. I welcome your thoughts. But I think, Clark, I'm going to share the full list in that article in our show notes, and I encourage our listeners to check that one out. But can you elaborate on two specifically for me? So if you bear with me, let me read these to our listeners. And then if you can just provide a quick commentary on each of these, that would be great. One of those myths is that, quote, if it looks like schooling, and then you go on to say, in general, content presentation doesn't lead to meaningful change in behavior in the absence of activity. I think you referred to that earlier, and I think that's such a great point. And then you go on to say that designed action and guided reflection, which looks a lot more like a lab or studio than a classroom, is what we want, end quote. Another myth that you share in your blog article is that, quote, SMEs know what needs to be learned. Research tells us to the contrary. Experts don't have conscious access to around 70% of what they do, though they do have access to what they know. Just accepting that an SME says and making content around that is likely to lead to a content dump and lack of behavior change. Instead, trust and ensure that your designers know more about learning than the SME and have practices to help address the problem, end quote. And just for our listeners, SMEs means subject matter experts. So Clark, what do you have to say to those two myths?
Right. As you mentioned, I did say a lot of people think if it looks like schooling, it's classrooms, and maybe I didn't articulate well enough what the alternative is. If you think about learning outside of school, your own independent learning, learning looks like action and reflection. You do something and then you think about it and decide whether it worked or not. So that suggests that instruction should be designed action and guided reflection. In other words, you very carefully give them a challenge, that problem to solve, and then scaffold the reflection. It may be providing some models or examples. It very definitely includes feedback on their performance, but it's doing things. You need to be doing the things in practice and training that you will be doing out in the real world. And whether it's negotiating or selling or operating this piece of software, it needs to be real practice. And so a lot of people don't get that and they resist being active. They just want to have fun. They just want to listen to charismatic trainer present stuff. And that isn't going to lead to any meaningful change. So that's part of the picture of what I was talking about. Now, one of the reasons we end up with content dumps is that subject matter experts, and it's the nature of our cognitive architecture, that we compile knowledge away. It becomes inaccessible. You know, for instance, trying to teach your kids to tie their shoes, it's very hard for you, for somebody to remember what it was like to tie your shoes back when you didn't have it so automatically in muscle memory that you could do it without thinking about it. That's the way our knowledge gets compiled away. And research has shown, and this is the Cognitive Technology Group at the University of Southern California, that 70% of what experts do actually isn't consciously accessible to them. They literally can't tell you what they do. You may remember the expert systems in the 80s, and they were going to build these systems that did what the experts said they did, and they built them and they failed, and they asked the experts. And then finally, they looked at the experts, and the correlation between what experts said they did, what they actually did, was pretty low. That's where we come up with this. When you go in and ask the subject matter expert, oh, what do they need to know? Particularly if you phrase it that way, you're going to get a knowledge dump. And the good little instructional designer will make sure they present that content. And you've got to go deeper. You've got to actually know what experts do. And you may have to observe them. You may have to triangulate from several different angles, from an expert, but also somebody who supervises practitioners. So it takes extra effort to figure out what the training actually needs to be about. Even, you know, once you've decided that it really does need to be in the head, you still can't just immediately start talking to the subject matter expert and take just straight what they give you. Otherwise, you'll end up getting a knowledge dump and you'll be back to school.
Yeah. Clark, thank you so much for that. And again, I encourage our listeners to check out not only that blog of the myths, but also your website. And we'll put that in our webpage as well. So Clark, as fellow practitioners and researchers and scientists, we absolutely benefit from learning from our colleagues and our friends, both boots on the ground as well as researchers. This question we ask, I think, every single one of our guests, because at the end of the day, this podcast is dedicated to collaborative learning and sharing and sharing practice and especially sharing research. There's a lot of great research out there that we love to share. So how would you summarize this conversation today? That is, if you had to distill your work into three or four sentences, what would you say to ERP organizational change practitioners and to private equity and to organizations in terms of effective learning and development? This is a very loaded question, but if you could just summarize all your knowledge and experience into a paragraph, what would you say?
Right. Well, I would flip that concept around where I said not doing, L&D isn't doing near what it could and should, and what it is doing, it's doing badly. I would flip that around and say, okay, first of all, start up front and make sure you're not using a course when you have a better solution. And that includes facilitating informal learning. Sometimes you want curation instead of creation as a mantra that says,
oh, that's great.
Let's not try and rebuild what somebody else has done. If we can find a good thing and what our people have collected, let's start sharing. Another mantra is resources over courses. Give people resources that may help them succeed. And that's what they're beginning to do. They're self-helping through Google and the like and finding YouTube videos to do things. then you can sort of relax on that part. So look beyond the course, look to performance sport. And then when you are doing courses, do them right. Make them have meaningful practice. Make them emotionally engaging as well as cognitively engaging. Provide the right resources, the minimal right resources. And as an organization, when you're looking for changes, don't just say, we'll develop it, do it, and then throw training at it. Let's get the design right to make it easy to support people in being successful. And then let's get the right support to help them being successful.
Well said. What great insight. Clark, thank you greatly for your time today. We truly appreciate your work. We appreciate your time. And for our listeners, please check out quinnovation.com. And this is in our show notes as well. quinnovation.com. As well as check out Clark's blog at blog.learnlets.com. That's LearnLets.com. And I assure you, you're going to find great learning and development articles there. So Clark, thank you again. Be well, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I encourage your people to get better aligned with how we think, work, and learn. Your organizations will benefit from it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of the ERP OCJ podcast. This podcast is intended as a forum to study, share, and discuss ERP organizational change successes and challenges. We discuss the people, process, and technological components of ERP organizational change by drawing on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner expertise and experience. We are incredibly grateful to have friends, colleagues, and mentors join us in our podcast as we seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community and contribute to its success by bringing research and practice closer together. We want to make sure this is the most useful and insightful ERP podcast you listen to, and we'd love your help in doing so by leaving us feedback and a review. A great place to do so is at Apple Podcasts. Just click on the Listen in Apple Podcasts link, then click Ratings and Reviews, and let us know your thoughts. You can get more info about the show, including show notes and episode highlights for this and all of our episodes, by visiting nesselandassociates.com and clicking the podcast option. Please join us again next week as we discuss the latest ERP organizational change research, practice, and stories. And don't forget to follow us on social media, hashtag the ERP OCJ. Thanks again for listening. Have a fantastic week.